This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Over the last year, the Kalamazoo School District has announced the largest high school graduating class since the Kalamazoo Promise was launched. KPS has also reported rising test scores and several new projects paid for by the largest bond request in district history that was approved by voters in May. Michael Rice is superintendent of Kalamazoo Public Schools. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's begin with the graduation rates. Is this further evidence of what the Kalamazoo Promise means to KPS?
Well, the promise is enormous for KPS. There's no question about that. We've grown by 2,500 students in the last 13 years. The promise began that 1,000-kid increase in its first year, 200-kid increase in our second year post-promise. So the promise deserves enormous credit for arresting a decline in enrollment and moving us up in a new direction. Since then, we've added a number of programs, improved student achievement, and I think a lot of those changes have helped in terms of the enrollment. So the promise is enormous. The program additions and program improvements are critical as well.
Graduation rates, are those up? In other words, can the number of graduates increasing be linked to something other than an increase in enrollment?
Right, so it's a great question. Yeah, absolutely, great question. So in June of 2005, 5 months prior to the promise, we had 454 graduates. This past summer, 692 graduates, an increase of 52%. Our enrollment has grown during the same period of time by 25%. So the enrollment increase is responsible for a little bit less than half of that growth in number of graduates. Our graduation rate has, in fact, increased. You may recall the president coming to Kalamazoo Public Schools, Kalamazoo Central High School graduation.
President Obama.
President Obama,
back in 2010.
Yes, that's exactly right. June 7, 2010, as the prize for the Race to the Top commencement challenge, a prize given for the work on creating or developing or moving toward a college-going culture. At that time, in 2010, we had a 63.1% graduation rate. This last year for which there were graduation rates published, 2017, so 7 years later, our graduation rate was 72.9%, an increase of 10 percentage points during that seven-year period of time. So you can see the improvement off what a number of people thought was really our high watermark in the district. You know, the president visits, gives a speech at one of your graduations. That's a pretty big deal. It was an enormous moment for our community and in our community's history. That said, we're so much stronger than we were several years ago. We do not have 2018 graduation rates yet. Those typically come out end of January, into February, or even early March from the state. The state takes 6 to 8 months to figure out where every high school student in the state who could or should have graduated is, to determine if that person counts as part of your graduation rate, as part of your dropout rate, or as neither because he or she is still in school.
One of the things that KPS has talked about often is the idea of a college-going culture. And
right.
One of the questions when the promise was announced is, well, what will happen to students who maybe started their school career and maybe even reached high school not really thinking college was an option? We've now reached a point where everybody who is in KPS started kindergarten,
right,
understanding that the promise was out there. Do you think that in some way changes the approach, at least, that maybe that students have across the board?
I think it changes the mindset for a number of our children and for a number of our families, not for all. Let me just share my thinking about this. If you're second or third generation college, or if you're going to be second or third generation college going, the promise hasn't changed your trajectory. It is what it was going to be. There are some young people for whom, and some families for whom, this hasn't had an impact. But there's a chunk of our population, a chunk of our young people and parents who are looking at this and saying, well, you know what? My neighbor did this. The kid down the block did this. The three kids from church did this. The five kids from the basketball league did it. So can I. And that has been really a game changer, the sorts of conversations you can have. Now, it doesn't kick in immediately. We do kindergarten promise signing ceremonies. And, you know, you have the children, you have their parents, you have the Bob Jorth from the Kalamazoo Promise, and I do these promise signing ceremonies. The five-year-olds aren't changed by those ceremonies, but their parents and grandparents, for them, there's an aha moment. There's a kind of an Arsenio Hall, one of these things that make you go, And it really gets parents and grandparents to sit up and to think about, hey, this is a $60,000 plus benefit over a four-year period of time, notwithstanding the fact that nobody in our family has graduated from high school and or that no one from our family has gone on to college. Maybe this can be the case for little Michael.
And you bring up an interesting point there. There is a mix, really, in the Kalamazoo District in terms of there are families who would be planning on college regardless of whether the promise was out there because they come from college-educated parents, grandparents, et cetera. But then there are many families who are really not in a financial position to plan on college otherwise if this gift is not out there.
There's no doubt about it. I mean, we're 70% free or reduced price lunch eligible. You know, the myth, not simply outside of Kalamazoo, but also in some cases within Kalamazoo, in pockets of Kalamazoo, is that somehow we're privileged because of the promise. The promise is an extraordinary gift from very, very generous, visionary, anonymous donors. But that does not make our children less poor growing up. It doesn't change their exposure growing up. 0 to 18, our kids are who they are, irrespective of the promise. The promise is a gift, as a scholarship, kicks in once they've graduated from high school. So absolutely, there are people who are tremendously, who are going to go to college and go on to college success irrespective of this. The game changer element of this from an educational perspective, and remember, the promise was put into place, we're told, ostensibly for economic development purposes. But from an educational perspective, the game-changing aspect of this are for the kids who weren't necessarily going, who all of a sudden say, why not me?
And do the graduation numbers that you see show improvement demographically for some of those students who in the past maybe were not getting to a high school diploma?
Absolutely. There's no question about that. So take, for example, African-American males. 5 years ago, 2013, African-American male graduation rate for graduating in 4 years, 46.7% in the district. 2017, 4 years later, we had increased African-American male graduating rate for graduating in 4 years, four straight years. It was up to 54.3% for the four-year rate. For the five-year rate, it was up to 63%. Now, I'm not suggesting that we uncork champagne over that. It's not the point. What I am suggesting, however, is you can see the market improvement. By the way, that 63% five-year rate compares to a state rate for African-American males of 65.5%. So we're 2.5 percentage points below the state rate, closing that gap. I look forward to seeing the 2018 rates when they are released in the coming month or two.
How much stock should we put in rising test scores? Because we will hear from educators all the time, we're tested too much, we don't like relying so much on testing. So when we see that the test scores are getting better, what does it really tell us?
So I think it really depends upon what tests we're talking about. You have to look at who's administering the tests, what the test is, are the tests reliable, are they valid? To what extent is there some ballast behind, sort of statistical ballast behind those tests? So the state for 40 years had MEEP testing. And in 2015, pivoted to MSTEP testing. We think the MSTEP test has pretty substantial challenges. We think that for a whole host of reasons, not the least of which is that at no grade level in the state, in no subject area in the state, do more than 50% of the children test as proficient. That should give us pause when you've got a test that basically says that fewer than 50% of the kids in the state, not in KPS, not in Comstock, not in Parchment, not in Portage, but in the state as a whole, in no grade, in no subject area, do 50% of the kids test at or above proficiency. So that makes you wonder about the test. The movement in state test results, particularly at the fifth and the eighth grade level, suggests that there are issues with the test. That said, improvements, all else being equal, are better than declines, number one. And we are up in every single area in mathematics. If you compare 16 results to 18 results, every grade level is up in mathematics. And we're closing the gap in every grade level in mathematics with the state. In reading, we are not up in every grade level, but we are closing the gap with the state in every grade level. In some cases, because the state has plummeted and our plummet has and our decline has been somewhat less. Do I hold a lot of stock in M-STEP testing? I most assuredly do not. NWA MAP testing, however, Gordon, is a nationally normed test. Millions of children take it each year. We've been giving that since 2015, and those results are up over the last 3 years. And I think that's to the credit of our educators, our support staff, our administrators, our community as a whole, and our kids.
Test results were one of the metrics that the state looked at when they were considering closing the Woodward School for Technology and Research and the Washington Writers Academy.
Correct.
What came out of that was a new school calendar.
Yep.
For those two schools. Is that working well?
So we started July 23rd, and we're not halfway through the year. We're not halfway through the year with the regular calendar. With their calendar, we're halfway through the year. Early returns are that it has benefited the school, but those are really early returns. We've basically had 5 months worth of school, a lot of analysis still to do. We don't know how this is going to sort of land, if you will. When we began the balanced calendar at Washington and Woodward, we got two reactions. One was, that's crazy, kids need a summer. And by the way, kids are still getting a summer. They're getting a 38-day summer, not an 81-day summer. So that's one piece. The second piece is that we were told, or we were asked, so when are you going to do this at the middle school level? Or when are you going to expand it to other elementary schools? Well, we get a year or two under our belts, and people realize it's not so strange that this actually has a pretty substantial value when the parents start talking it up, when the kids start talking it up. I think you're going to see a lot more people being interested in it. And I believe that this is truly a wave of the future, that in 20 years, the entire district will operate on some sort of calendar roughly like this. We've put in place, you mentioned the bond, the $96.7 million bond approved in May of 2018. You know, in the last 11 years, we've put in 960,000 square feet of air conditioning in the district. That's more than in the preceding 100-plus years of the district's history. With this bond from 18 to 22, 200,000 more square feet of air conditioning, we will have air conditioned two-thirds of the district. My point is that increasingly we have the ability not simply to expand this over a period of years, but also to make the district fully on some sort of a balanced calendar. Now, I want to be clear about this. This is not going to happen a year, 2 years, 3 years. We're talking a couple of decades because it'll take another couple of decades to finish the air conditioning of the district in its entirety.
Going to school in July and August requires, if we get into August at some point, change the calendar around.
I think you almost have to do it. My point of this is that you can have a few specialty schools, a few magnet schools that have this opportunity, and it doesn't have to be two. It could be three or four as well. We've got a Montessori school North Glade Montessori. We've got a dual language school, El Sol Elementary, begun in 2008. We've got a middle school alternative learning program, 2008. So this is a nice addition to the set of opportunities in the district.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm speaking with Kalamazoo Schools Superintendent Michael Rice. You can find our interviews at WMUK.org, the WMUK app, and also through WMUK's West Southwest podcast. You can subscribe through Apple iTunes and Google. Do you think it is a good idea to examine other countries? I ask this because I have a sister who lives in the UK, so I have a nephew and niece who attend school. They actually end for summer about the third week of July, about when Washington Woodward were starting this year, and then they start in Labor Day. But, I mean, is it worth looking at other countries and how they do this, or is
Yes.
the American experience different?
It is worth looking at other countries. The challenge becomes convincing other people of the relevance of looking at other countries, because we're pretty convinced in our country that what we do and how we do it is the kitten's little whiskers. The reality is there are things to learn not simply from other countries, but also from other districts in the state, in the country, and we're constantly looking for those lessons. But as you know, the idea of the more balanced calendar at Washington and Woodward is have a shorter summer, less summer slide, and as a result, less summer slide from which to recover. What we know about the education of, particularly of poor children who do not get an enormous amount of exposure to literature over the summer, to books, to libraries, and the like, is that they grow during the school year, but they slide in their reading levels during the summer because they're not reading on average as much as their middle class counterparts. Well, if you reduce the amount of summer, you reduce the amount of slide, and over a period of years, you're more likely to grow. But it really has to be over a period of years.
And just to go back to this calendar, there are more breaks built in, correct?
Yes, sir.
So the number of days these students are going to school, it's the same as everybody else in the district. Is that right?
That is true. The number of days, the same. The number of hours, the same. They are configured differently, and there is no yawning 81-day summer break. Ideally, my view, not everybody's view, but ideally we would have a longer school year. You talk about lessons learned from the UK. Lessons learned from other countries include the fact that a longer school year generates more student achievement. But we couldn't afford a longer school year. There's, I think, a feeling among a number of our staff members, not all, but a number of our staff members, that a longer school year would benefit kids. But you have to be able to pay for a longer school year. And in order for that to happen, you'd have to be able to get more money from the state.
All right. Well, let's talk about that for a little bit.
Sure.
There was an election, so we have a different governor now. We have new members of the state legislature. Do you see anything that makes you think that that's going to change that dynamic in terms of how much money's coming to local schools?
Well, I'm very optimistic about the new governor. She's extremely supportive of public schools, of public education. She's spoken very strongly about the need for an expansion of pre-kindergarten. State-funded pre-kindergarten. I think that's really powerful. She's spoken very passionately about the need to improve literacy levels and to fund the improvement of new literacy levels, not simply to hope for new literacy levels or to pray for new literacy levels, but actually to fund literacy coaches in schools. For example, she's been very strong on the need to continue the improvement of career and technical education, which began under the preceding governor. So I am optimistic about where she is with respect to public education. That said, a governor doesn't hold the purse strings. The legislature does. And the legislature really properly ought to be focused on improving public education, and not with an approach that resembles the beatings will continue until morale increases, but rather an approach that talks about how are we going to really support and raise up our public educators. As you may be aware, public education in the state has really been denigrated pretty profoundly over the last decade. One of the manifestations of that, one of the many manifestations of that, is that the number of teacher ed candidates across the state, including right here on campus at Western, has plummeted. 30, 35, 40, 45% decline in teacher ed candidates. We've got to get to back to the point where we're raising up the profession of teaching, of public education, where we're supporting it more financially. Because in the absence of that, we're going to be forced, not because it makes better sense given the experience of other countries, but we're going to be forced into other models for public education that are cheaper models, but they are not better for children. And that would really be a travesty.
Let me ask you about a couple of the things that are coming out of that bond proposal voters approved in May. Food and nutrition. What do you see coming out of this? There's supposed to be a district-wide kitchen, and sure. Is this going to mean that the food that kids are served at school is going to be healthier?
It will mean that the food is going to be healthier. You know, if you look at the food we serve kids, it's fine. It meets USDA standards and so on and so forth. But if we have a better centralized kitchen, which was approved by our voters in May of 2018, we're going to be able to do more scratch cooking. And the food is going to be, it's just going to be better food. It's going to be better food. It's going to be more interesting food for our kids. They're going to be more likely to eat that interesting food. You know, when we build a new school or when we redo a cafeteria, when we redo substantially a given school, we redo the cafeteria as well. So if you go into Linden Grove, that's a modern cafeteria. And if to go into Linden Grove, into that cafeteria, is to say, wow, this could be, really, this could be at a Pfizer. This could be at a Stryker. This could be, at a downtown a cafeteria. Now, you know, you're serving 6th through 8th graders. And so, you know, there is the fact that we've got 750 11 through 14 year olds there. But the food is good, and it's what you'd expect at a cafeteria that serves a lot of people. But I do think this centralized, this district-wide cooking facility will serve us well. It's not that we don't have one now, but it's remarkably constrained for service for 13,000 kids.
What sort of security upgrades will come about as a result of the bond?
Right. So we have more than 1,000 cameras in the district. We've added those over a period of years. We have cameras on our buses. We've added those over a period of years. We have buzzer intercom camera systems at the front doors of all of our schools. We've added those over a period of years. We have more human security, more security officers. We have a police officer at each of the two comprehensive high schools, Norix and Central. The bond will add secure entrances at 15 of our schools, not our elementary schools, 15 of our total schools in the district. And what I mean by that is that currently you have buzzer intercom camera system. They buzz you in, but in some cases you're not in the office. You're in a hallway. What we want is you to be buzzed in and you move right into an office space with no opportunity to go anywhere else but that office space. So we're going to be doing 8 of these secure entrance projects this summer with another 7 over the life of the bond.
Of course, when we start talking security, we think of shootings which have happened at schools or near schools. How often are you reviewing procedures for things like lockdowns and active shooter drills, those sort of things?
You know, we began this year ALICE training, alert, lockdown, inform, counter, evacuate training. ALICE means different things to different people, and ALICE's restaurant, of course, means different things to different people. But this is a really, really important area. It's an area that we've worked with our parents on, with our staff on. ALICE training is essentially active shooter training. And you can say, well, you haven't had an active shooter. we haven't had an active shooter, and they hadn't had an active shooter in Newtown before they had one, in Parkland before they had one, in Santa Fe before they had one, in Edinburgh, Pennsylvania, or Paducah, Kentucky, or Jonesboro, Arkansas, until they had one. And so what we're trying to do is to prepare for that possibility. Do we think it's going to happen? On average, it doesn't happen in communities. But we want to be as prepared as possible if it were to happen. So this ALICE training is in two parts. The first part is 45 minutes online, individual professional development for individual staff members. The second part is a two-hour chunk with your school staff. And in a couple of cases, in a number of cases, combined. So, for example, Lincoln and Edison did their ALICE training together, 2 hours. Local law enforcement, our chief of police, our chief of security, Don Webster, working with our staff to understand the elements of this. You know, it used to be that you essentially you heard there was an active shooter. What you basically dove for cover. This is different. This is more subtle. If you can get away, you do get away. If you can't, you fight like heck. You counter. And that's a little bit different from the less that you know, that's a lesson out of Columbine. That's a lesson out of Newtown. That you don't simply, you know, hole up. But if that active shooter is close to you, then it's on. And that requires some measure of training with staff. Our staff have been outstanding in the training. They've really focused on it hard. They've taken it seriously. They care about it a lot. We think our schools are safe, but they thought their schools were safe in Newtown and in Santa Fe and in Parkland. I'm not suggesting that they weren't. I'm suggesting that if someone is bent on doing harm, it can happen for a brief period of time. You want to mitigate that to the extent possible.
Dr. Rice, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Michael Rice is superintendent of the Kalamazoo Public School District. WMUK's West Southwest podcast is available through Apple, iTunes, and Google. You can subscribe to the podcast, leave a rating, and write a review. The interviews can also be found at WMUK.org and through the WMUK app. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.